You're about to listen to the Complete Developer Podcast, the podcast by coders, for coders, about all aspects of life as a developer.
I'm Will, the curmudgeonly experienced developer.
And I'm Beege, the optimistic newbie developer.
Complete Developer Podcast is supported by listeners like you. We are now on Patreon at www.patreon.com/Complete Developer Podcast.
Hello, Music City Code! This week, we have a special episode. It is our 100th episode, and so we have a live panel here at Music City Code where we will be discussing the future of software development and changes to come over the next 5 years or so. But before we get started, Will, what have you been fighting this week?
Well, this week I've mostly spent getting ready for Music City Code and enjoying Music City Code. That's been the central focus, pretty much. That's really all I got. Like a lot of like lugging things around and trying to find where to set up booths and that sort of stuff. So I don't know. I guess that's really the sum of it. How about you?
A lot of the same stuff. I spent most of the early part of this week working on getting everything at work ready for me to be gone for 2 days for Music City Code. And now I'm just having a great time here. I've been attending sessions mostly on C# 7 and some on converting from AngularJS or Angular 1 to Angular 2. That's something that we're looking at doing. Well, the developers are wanting to do as soon as possible, but we're working on talking management into letting us do at work. Now, as Will mentioned, we've been spending some time at the booth. He spent more time there than I have so far this week. I have to go to so many lectures to kind of justify me being here for work, but our booth is located right between Nashville Software School and Free Code Camp. So I've been seeing a lot of friends and people that we know when I'm not in the session, which has been really cool. It's been really nice just, you know, hanging out with the NSS folk and hanging out with one of the guys from Free Code Camp is a good friend of ours. He's been on the show, Dave Harned. And so it's been a lot of fun hanging out with him. And then the other guy that runs the group here in Nashville is pretty awesome, too. Unfortunately, I haven't gotten to spend as much time as Will has with him.
Yeah. Well, I spent hours and hours and hours at the booth. Got to hang out with, you know, like the Nashville Software School people. Like, it's interesting because I've met so many people that have gone through there, but I hadn't met anybody that was actually involved in it from a teaching capacity or a organizational capacity. And so it was neat kind of seeing the other side of that.
Well, like yesterday we had one of the teachers and then today we have one of the founders there, and he actually interviewed me when I considered going to school there. That was a couple of years ago. So he interviews a lot of people, didn't remember me until I mentioned I'd been to med school, and he's like, "Oh, I remember you now."
Yeah.
It's like, "You had some really great code samples." I was like, "Yeah, that's because he was my mentor and pointed to Will." Yeah. He's like, "Ooh."
Yeah.
But speaking of Will, he actually sent me this week's IoTs. So let's go ahead and roll the music. This week for IoTs, I have something that Will and I are actually planning on building ourselves. That is a Raspberry Pi VPN server. Using OpenVPN software, you can build your own virtual private network. By using a Raspberry Pi, you'll be able to create a 24/7 VPN that doesn't consume much power, but is powerful enough to handle a few connections at a time.
Yeah, we actually need this because we want to get a working VPN set up, and I want it to be outside of my router because it's, I don't know, the router one has been really flaky with OpenVPN.
It would just
be better if we had two devices, both of them being Raspbian, that know how to talk to each other.
Connect to that, and then they're already.
Yeah, that's
true. You can also use it to connect your devices from outside your local network, just like they were in the network. It's a long process to set up, but this tutorial is pretty simple to follow, and it kind of walks you through all the steps necessary. I'll have a link to it in the show notes. Who's talking to us this week?
Well, being that it's Music City Code, pretty much freaking everybody. yeah. And of course, I'm sure my daughter's listening right now and hearing me use the word freaking and going, he said a bad word. But that aside, we got a tweet during the recording from Connor Bush. This is live podcast. Hashtag Music City Code, at Complete Dev Pod, at Music City Code, at Reverend Geek, at Gaines K, at Steve Grunwell. And what he posted was a picture of us at the panel discussion, along with a picture of the guys from Duck Dynasty. Now, if you haven't seen the panel discussion pictures, you may not understand this, but let's just say that there were some large beards involved.
And not just ours. At Reverend Geek is David Neal.
His beard is magnificent.
Yeah. I mean, his is something to aspire to.
Yeah.
Connor, that pic was hilarious.
Yes. I've shown it to everybody.
Oh, yeah. My dad absolutely loved it when I sent it to him. I think what I'm going to try to do is get that picture and put it in the show notes for this episode. So if you're listening on iTunes or Stitcher or something, check out the show notes to see the picture we're talking about. When we get a new order of water bottles, we've got one just for you.
And our friend Chang Lee also commented on the tweet. It says, magnificent beard collection in the 100th episode of At Complete Dev Pod at Music City Code. Chang, it's obvious we'll order a water bottle for you too. And, you know, we know where to find you.
Yeah.
Makes that easy.
So guys, if you'd like your very own Complete Developer water bottle, leave us a review in iTunes or comment on the website or any of our social media. We post all our episodes to Facebook, LinkedIn, Google+, and of course, Twitter. We're also on Path and Tumblr. Due to some time constraints on some of our guests, we recorded the intro and tricks of the trade after the actual episode. So we're going to go ahead and jump back into the episode.
The future is often a scary, uncertain place for people. Everyone likes to project how things will turn out for them in the future. Tech folks are no different in this regard, and we've assembled a group of knowledgeable developers to discuss what we think is coming over the next 5 years. We're doing this live at Music City Code with a panel, and on this panel we have David Neal, Gaines Kergeson, and Steve Grunwell.
Grunwell.
I had to get you, man.
He did that on purpose because of what you said. So just for the audience, we were talking to Steve, making sure we pronounced his name right. And he said it always bugged him when people mispronounced it that way.
Yeah, no. Beach got it right the first time. He's like, is it Grunwell? Is that how you say it? And it's like, yeah.
I was just confused how you pronounced my name right, Kergeson, and got his wrong.
He asked your wife how to pronounce it.
Yeah, I figured if Mary was okay with the way I pronounced it, you could be made okay with it.
All right, so we're going to just go down the line and have you guys give us a brief introduction to yourself. David, we'll start with you.
Hey, this is David Neal, and I am a software developer. I no longer self-identify as a .NET developer. I use lots of different technologies, and looking forward to I don't know.
Yeah, congratulations for getting over that .NET issue you had there from two .NET developers here.
Hi, my name is Gaines Kergeson, and I'm a recovering software developer. Hi, Gaines.
Hi, Gaines. Okay.
I am an associate director at UBS, and I work with their corporate branding team. But most of my time is frankly spent working on the conference Music City Code and speaking at other conferences.
My name is Steve Grunwell. I'm a senior software engineer at a hosting company called Liquid Web. I'm also primarily a PHP guy, so I really don't know what I'm doing in Nashville, but it's a lovely city. I'm glad to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you here, and we shared a couple of beers the other night, so...
more than a couple, as I recall.
Yeah, this is the first time we've recorded without beer.
It was a very large value of couple.
That's true.
I have to say, perhaps my favorite part of Nashville so far is the beer. So
that's awesome.
Followed shortly thereafter by, of course, the conference. Yes. Give it up for Nashville beer. And, of course, the conference and the music and the history and all that fun stuff. But
beer brought to you by Yazoo Brewery.
Yes, it was.
Yes, it was. All right. So, gentlemen, first question I guess we'll get started with is, how do you think developer education is going to change in the next 5 years? Don't all answer at once.
It seems like the latest trend has definitely been the boot camps, right? Mm-hmm. It's get people from other industries in with just enough training to get their feet in the door, which with the demand we have right now is helping to meet it. I expect that we might see a blowback from that, though, because there's so many people going through this process that don't have the right mindset to be learners and to improve and to have a long-term career in software development, at least one that progresses past entry level. I'm wondering what's going to come next, what's going to fill that gap when people say, you know what, boot camps are great for people who can take some instructions and write some code, but we really need people who can progress beyond that to principles and patterns.
I would agree completely with what Gaines said. I think you're going to find a lot of people who plateau and kind of decide that, you know, yes, I'm technically employed as a software developer. I've reached a certain point and I can write code, but I'm not necessarily solving problems. I'm not applying the critical thinking, the stuff that really makes for a standout developer. You'll, of course, certainly have people who get into it because they enjoy puzzles, because they enjoy solving problems, and they'll climb those ranks, but I think you're going to have a lot of people kind of right at that high junior, low mid level stuff, just kind of, you know, spinning their wheels, building the same kinds of things over and over. Of course, I hope they find things that actually interest them and they don't just treat it as, well, this is what I'm going to be doing until I retire. But it's a, I think we're going to saturate the market with a lot of people who may not be as driven or passionate about software as the people who started, say, 5-10 years ago and got into it because that was what they really enjoyed.
JavaScript.
Yeah, that's good.
So what major changes do you foresee in the way the development community interacts with each other over the next 5 years?
A Slack channel for all the things all the time. So many Slack channels. They'll be the best Slack channels.
I already have a bunch of those, so yeah. I follow you on that.
Like 100 Slack teams per developer, minimum. And it's going to be, we'll get nothing done, but the memes will be on point.
Isn't that now?
No. Don't you mean the memes will be on fleek?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm approaching 30, so I'm clearly falling out of the zeitgeist.
Oh, yeah.
It's an older meme, but it checks out, sir.
I see a trend in consulting where people try to focus on problem solving and providing solutions rather than technologies. And I think that might be the direction that the industry is going to eventually go. I don't know if it's going to be in the next 5 years, but tools, the part of the reason why tools get developed and enhanced is to abstract away the technical aspect and focus on the problem solving. So it's just a natural progression that as our tooling gets better, as our frameworks handle more of the grunt work, we're going to be focusing more on people who can think about the problems and come up with creative solutions and understand the ways to go about that in a way that's maintainable and scalable and all those concerns that you have as a more senior developer. And we're going to see less need for the coders, the pure technical implementers.
A trend we're already starting to see is the rise of the microservice, right? Where we have a lot of software as a service providers who say, we're going to build one thing that operates really well, and you call my API, so you're able to do this one tiny thing you need to do, you get your response, and then that's where that relationship ends. So I think we're going to see a lot of people focusing on solving those problems that we as developers find ourselves solving over and over again, abstracting those to services, making those available. From there, we'll likely run into the, well, who really owns our data conversation? And that those are already starting. The GitLab issue a few months ago where they lost like a day's worth of data comes to mind, where suddenly people are like, oh, maybe we should take more ownership of what we're doing. But I think microservices are going to continue to grow. As a result, we're going to be focusing on writing more of the glue rather than the underlying business logic.
JavaScript.
And you guys kind of touched on this, and I just want to ask you guys anything else to add, but this, because the next question we had was, what major changes do you see in the way that the developer community interacts with everyone else, the business world and with the consumer world?
If it isn't already, which sadly I don't think it is, but it certainly should be, security is going to be a big talking point for the next few years, especially as people are willingly submitting a lot of their information to random one-off microservice providers or to platforms like Facebook that just are able to aggregate huge amounts of data about people. I think and hope that the consumer level audience is going to start paying more attention to what information they're putting out there, how it's being used, whether it's for good or evil, as subjective as that may be, and hopefully taking more personal responsibility rather than just seeing, you know, the internet as, oh, this is still some other. Because, you know, it used to be on the internet, no one knows if you're a dog. And now it's on the internet, everybody knows that, you know, you prefer this particular brand of toilet paper because you like them on Facebook. So as we put more information out there about ourselves, I'm hoping that consumers are going to start paying more attention. And as a result, developers are going to be able to start really focusing on how can we protect user privacy, user data, control who has access to that information, and generally not get spammed with toilet paper ads. Not that that's ever happened to me.
So I guess maybe we should ask the question, what world is outside the developer community? Because we're kind of entering a world where everything is development. Every kid coming out of school is going to know how to write formulas and create some basic software. So it might just become a matter of how focused are you on development as part of your job, just like any other skill.
If I may sneak in a plug for the conference here, Sarah Phelps had a fantastic talk yesterday about the ways that we can start introducing programming concepts to children. So I think what Gaines said is 100% correct. Programming stops being this is something that neckbeards are hanging out in basements doing, with all due respect to the hosts of this podcast. And more, you know, to what degree are you dealing with programming and problem solving? Because at its core, programming isn't about the software, it's about solving the problem. And it doesn't matter if you're an accountant, if you're a chef, if you're an auto mechanic, your job is to solve problems. And as more and more things start moving to, we happen to be powered by code, I think there is definitely a convergence where suddenly code and programming concepts are not this strange, abstract thing that, you know, only wizards with, again, no offense, neckbeards can do.
I definitely don't take offense to being called a wizard, so.
You know, David actually kind of hit on this during his talk yesterday. He was talking about public speaking, but I think this kind of has been brewing in my mind a little bit for a while, and it's the idea that maybe developers are going to kind of come down out of the clouds a little bit. You know, we as an industry, there's a pretty good chunk of people that look down on other departments, especially like looking down at the marketing folks and the sales folks and the business folks. And I think now the roles are starting to blend a little bit, and they're starting to realize that, hey, these are normal people, you know, pretty much just like us with maybe less neck beardage. And I think that humility coming through the community is probably a huge help for all of us, because it's making the communities more pleasant to be around just in general, and it's making them more welcoming to newcomers. So we're going to get a lot of new blood in because of that.
And David said all this with one word, JavaScript.
It's a weird,
that's what I meant.
It's a weird place if JavaScript is how we welcome people, but okay.
Now, Will, if we come down from the clouds, can we still, like, retreat back and then come down to be developer ex machina and save the day with code? Because that's kind of one of the big perks of the job.
Well, I think once you come down out of the clouds, you're not in the clouds anymore.
Oh, but
you have to plant the magic seeds and then climb the beanstalk, and then you can get back to the clouds.
Oh, that's far too mythological.
Java.
Java beans. You have to have a beanstalk factory, actually.
I'm pretty sure there's an NPM package for that, though.
So how do you guys foresee the developer hiring process changing in the next 5 years?
Remote working has certainly become more common, and it's going to continue to do so. So we're going to see a lot less focus on local resources and more focus on capabilities, both from a technical perspective and maybe more importantly, the cultural perspective or communications. You know, there's always been a barrier with overseas resources to be on the same time zone and to be able to communicate well and understand why each other said the things you said. But I think as those geographic barriers become less important, we're going to see more focus on connecting with people remotely like that.
And I see a trend towards less resume-driven hiring process and more towards skill-based and being able to demonstrate skills and so forth. I think it's we're getting beyond the phase of just going by what's on someone's resume and or even doing, you know, the esoteric tests that we've done in the past around being able to demonstrate we've got certain skills or whatever, having to whiteboard, you know, problems during interviews that are so scary, and just being able to demonstrate this is a body of work that I have. It exists on GitHub. You can go and look and see what someone is capable of doing, and you can make assessments, you know, on those kinds of things. And we have social media where people can make assessments on the character and personality and be able to determine culture fits, or if you will.
So if you could productize this service to research candidates based on their social media interaction and their contributions online, you might have something there.
Big data.
The fear I have is that you're going to be really close to crossing a line of not hiring someone because of a political belief or because of this or that, and you risk that, and it may be because I work for the state that I think in the, okay, we have to be like everyone has an equal opportunity kind of stuff, but yeah, I worry about that with the idea of productizing that, automating it, I guess.
I certainly hope that we're still human about it, that this is not the yes or no tool. It's just a way that we can assess who the candidates get in the pool.
Yeah.
Well, it seems to me a product would actually be less likely to do that. A platform that could evaluate candidates for you is less likely to be prejudiced against candidates. You're not going to tell it, don't hire Muslims. You're going to tell it, I want somebody who's good at these things, and it's going to go out and find those for you.
That's true. And one thing I have noticed with some HR departments, though, is, and if it's designed by developers, knowing what to look for, knowing like the different ways of wording things, but something I've noticed with larger HR departments is you have to know the right wording to get past them to get to the person that knows what they're looking for. And I guess that is another fear with that of, again, automating that, knowing what to put in it.
I think this whole discussion kind of revolves around the fact that we all know the hiring process is broken horribly right now. That's why we're seeing the whiteboard interview problems, is we don't, on average, have a really good way to assess a candidate without putting them in that situation. Because from a hiring manager perspective, whiteboard interviews suck. It's not any fun for the manager either. And it's one of those things that you do because that's the only way you can come up with to handle the problem. And it seems like there ought to be some better way to do it. And I'm wondering if we're not going to solve this in the next few years.
The best way I've seen to do it is create a problem for them to solve. And it doesn't have to be complicated. And I've seen it done with virtual machines where you remote into a server and you fix some code. Just something to see that they can illustrate a competency or a level of skill or a type of skill that you're looking for. Just that indicator, not the entire thing.
Yeah, that does make sense. And I know what you were talking about David, with the looking at their body of work. We've started doing that because we've been hiring a lot lately, and we've been looking a lot at their GitHub repos and stuff. And so, like, when you were saying that, I was thinking, yes, that is something I am seeing a lot of, is looking at that, less of what your resume looks like and what your education background looks like, and more of, okay, what have you done? What do you bring to the table when we hire you?
Is it possible, though, that that kind of trend could make people less likely to contribute code easily to open source solutions? If they feel like it has to be perfect because anything they put out there is going to represent them in a potential employment opportunity?
It absolutely can freak people out. I mean, I don't know if there's any process for assessment that isn't going to make somebody get into some kind of panic. On the other hand, it does represent a pretty good opportunity for the people that are willing to jump into open source. And, you know, maybe that behavior will get normalized. You know, everybody probably 15 years ago wouldn't have been comfortable posting as much stuff on Facebook or Twitter as they do now. So, things kind of shift over time, I would think. But it's going to be rough for a little bit. Just like Facebook is rough, always.
Is it worth saying that when we're looking, as people looking to hire developers, when we're looking at GitHub contributions, it's not the specific contributions, but the trends. Is this someone who's sitting there
and is working on one project and really is passionate about this project? Or is this someone who's going, hey, I can contribute a little there, a little there. They may not be perfect patches. There might be a lot of back and forth in the pull requests, but it's someone who's willing to engage, willing to put themselves out there. I know that as I'm not a manager now, but when I was, you know, one of the things that I would look for was, is this someone who's actually interested in what they're doing? Or are they just saying, I have to have perfect code out there because otherwise it might exclude me from a job down the road?
Yeah, I know when I interviewed for the job I have now, we barely talked about coding or anything. We geeked out about podcasts and geeked out about coding, but it wasn't a interview quite like question back and forth. It was like he was more assessing my enjoyment of coding and how involved I was in it. And I really think that that helped me to get that job was because I love what I do. And that makes a lot of sense because I was told that after the interview once I started that he came out and told the rest of the team how excited he was for that interview.
You know, you brought up something interesting. Do you think there's a negative aspect to evaluating someone's character in that it creates a very homogenous culture where everybody tries to hire people like them that they like personally more than hiring people for their abilities?
I think it does that. And I also think that it is going to force everybody to be a fake. And so you'll hire people that you think you like, and then 6 months in, the mask falls off. That's what I would be afraid of.
I would argue that perhaps it could do the opposite. Again, looking at the larger trends of people, if you see someone who's regularly confrontational in pull requests, they submit something, the maintainer of the repository goes, I don't really agree with this change, not a fan of the direction, and they kind of go, well, you're wrong. That would be a big red flag that like, yes. Okay, this developer does not play well with others. At the same time, going back to what Gaines was saying about an increase in remote work, I mean, that means a lot to me just because I've been working remotely almost exclusively for the past 3 years at this point. And I'm in Columbus, Ohio. Not a bad tech market, but the companies I work for, I worked for a company called TenUp that was a distributed agency, people all around the world. I'd log on and I'd be talking with people in Liverpool, people in Italy, people in India, Poland, California, Mexico. It was just this great, I can work with people all over the world. So the remote nature of everything actually helped fight some of that homogeny because we're not dealing with like, well, it's a bunch of, you know, white guys working in the valley because, hey, why not, right?
So what do you guys think the next big wave will be in mobile in the next 5 years?
JavaScript.
Well, it might be built with some form of JavaScript that Microsoft or somebody might be working on. I definitely think it's going to be along the lines of augmented reality. We're going to get away from the screens and the devices that you hold in your hand and start integrating them more into the way we interact with the world and take ourselves away from the immersion in a device and bring the device into the world around us.
So instead of Google Glass, we'll have Google contact lenses?
I'm ready to sign up for the ocular implant, personally.
That would be kind of cool.
As long as it can't get hacked, I guess.
Yeah.
That's a big if.
Well, actually, if it could get hacked, there's people that would probably sell that service.
Sure. You know? Great advertising.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's basically a drug, right? It's a hallucinogen.
There was a movie kind of like that not that long ago. Well, by not that long ago, I probably mean early to mid-90s.
You're dating yourself a bit here.
Well, no one else will, so I might as well. So, well, this does actually kind of lead into the next question, which is, how do you think the Internet of Things will impact the development landscape?
Not to be the security whistleblower on the panel, but I think it's one of those, right now with Alexa, with Google Home, everyone's like, oh, this is really cool. I can talk to this thing, and it's always listening. And I look at it, and I go, oh, I can talk to this thing, and it's always listening. my father-in-law, for instance, he and his wife, they have an Alexa, and he's an engineer, so he's restricted it to one room of the house purely as a, hey, Alexa, play whatever music. He's like, I don't want it listening to me anywhere else because I know what happens with this data. Like, absolutely not. But my mother-in-law is like, well, but it could be really nice to be able to say, hey, Alexa, play jazz. And if anyone has an Alexa and is listening to this podcast, we really just messed with them. Which is
I was thinking that too.
Okay, Google, play jazz. But I think you're going to see some backlash when people start realizing, oh, we've invited this cute little Alexa into our home. And now it is always listening. And I think the political climate has contributed to that. I say again, living in the North, being in my so-called bubble, but I think you see a lot of people kind of going like, you know what? Maybe I don't want all this information about me out there and constantly being collected. Then again, it's a trade-off that you play, where other people want to be able to say, I don't want to have to ever touch a keyboard again. I just want to be able to voice command all the things and have the technological future we've envisioned in movies and science fiction for years.
So what you're saying is you don't want to log on to Amazon and have it pop up with an ad that says, hey, we heard you holler at your wife to bring you toilet paper. Do you need to order some?
Oh, the toilet paper thing. That's not going to die, is it?
No. You mentioned it.
Podcast regrets. My memoir.
I'm quite the optimist in hoping how the world will turn out. But if you look at trends, I mean, Facebook, it's pretty obvious that to the majority of people that it's collecting information and using it. I mean, you could see that right on your timeline. And people just don't care. I'm not really sure what it's going to take to reach a tipping point where the convenience of daily life is not worth the security compromise to the average person.
You know what's not listening? JavaScript. That was your cue.
Not yet. That's coming in the next version of ES.
Yes. Is that ES9? 8?
7. Yeah. Or ES Overlords.
Change the name. Well, you've already hit on data science a little bit with your security, but how do you see data science changing?
I think it's one of those things where we're going to do a lot of really fun stuff, and there are going to be a lot of really interesting things that we're going to do with the data. It's going to embarrass the hell out of some people, and then backlash. Again, apparently I always go to backlash. I just keep thinking this is going to happen, and then of course I remember people go, no, I'm really lazy. I really just want computers to do everything for me. But the amount of data, the petabytes upon what's bigger than a petabyte? What's the next?
Exabyte.
The exabytes of data being collected at this point, it's really astounding. And I think there's a lot of good that can come from it. But I think there's also a lot of, if this is used in the wrong way, could really put some people in difficult situations.
And it's kind of sexy to think about some evil villain or government organization using data in a way we don't like. But I think what we're going to find is more common is data being ignorantly used in ways that it maybe to get answers that it doesn't actually give you, but it's all about how you ask the question and what data you're looking at. Right now, the data science world doesn't really seem to be focused on the social sciences as part of how it's interacting with this data and what kind of conclusions it's drawing. And as we see it permeate more and more of our lives, I wonder if we're going to see some really damaging conclusions being drawn because they haven't considered how this data is gathered and how the conclusions they're drawing are going to affect the world that they're applying it in.
So kind of the classic correlation does not equal causation. Or in programming terms, correlation does not triple equal causation.
Right. Just not understanding the problem you're trying to solve or the answer you're getting and applying it incorrectly, but being completely confident in its correctness because, hey, it's data. It's data science. It's got to be right. It's generated by a computer.
Well, we already have that. If you ever buy a toaster on Amazon, Amazon assumes that this is the beginning of your hobby of collecting toasters.
Right.
So, I mean, it's going to be there from now on.
But at this point, we're just talking about suggestions. We're not talking about things that actually control your life and make it more convenient, like your car driving you to the place that it thinks you want to go to.
Toaster Emporium on 5th.
We'll open a special toilet paper emporium just for you.
I will rule this land.
That cutting down all the trees.
I'm looking forward to the evolution of data science and helping us to live our lives better. I'm looking forward to living in a world that does have all the conveniences of being able to cater to my interests and things that I'm interested in and suggesting things for me and helping me not to get off the couch.
I will say that one other thing I'm finding interesting about all the data science stuff is the focus towards processing just huge amounts of data efficiently. We really don't even know where that goes, even outside of just the data science thing. We're having to come up with better ways of structuring things, better ways of accessing data quickly, distributing loads. You know, all that kind of stuff is going to feed into the rest of computer science. And it'll be really interesting to see where that leads us in 5 years, irrespective of the data science input. So this is the last one. What are the biggest threats you see to information technology over the next 5 years? I have a guess what at least one of those answers is.
Is it JavaScript? Please tell me it's JavaScript.
Okay, I had a guess about two answers.
David, would you like to go ahead and
JavaScript?
So please elaborate. How is JavaScript going to be a threat?
It's a cancer, but it's beautiful.
Well stated, sir. Well stated.
You keep using those words. I do not think they mean what you think they mean. No, I mean, since it's been my soapbox this entire broadcast, I think one of the biggest threats is we make it very easy for people to share a lot of information about themselves, whether it's an explicit, I'm filling out a form and saying, yes, these are my preferences, or whether it's an implicitly, you know, we've analyzed your behavior and based on that, we can assume X, Y, and Z. People being unaware of how that data is being used could be a potential attack vector. Phishing campaigns are getting super, super focused, where you're able to go, okay, with very few resources, I can aggregate the information I need about you to figure out where you bank, you know, what kind of stuff you like. Oh, click here to opt in to this bank program where I can win free football tickets, you know, to the football fan who uses Chase. Great. That's very easy information to come across. And very easy to do a very targeted phishing campaign. Now, hopefully this person has money, otherwise the phisher has just wasted his or her time. But I think general ownership of data, aggregation of data that people might not be explicitly providing, these are things that are cause for concern. Maybe not, you know, reason to be up in arms right now, because again, these are things that we are providing at least implicitly by doing things like purchasing, you know, hardware that listens all the time. If we were smart, we'd think, maybe there are downsides to this. But we look at it and we go, ooh, shiny, I can order more toilet paper from the couch. And it even knows my brand. There, full circle. And now I own the meme, so it's worth nothing to anybody else.
I think the greatest threat is one we already have among us, and we may not even be aware of the extent of the damage that's already done because it's not the sort of thing anybody really wants to focus on. There's no regulation currently around what kind of standards are needed in order to develop software when it comes to what that software is being used for. There are a lot of regulations around maybe how that software has to perform, but in order to enforce that, it first has to not perform the way it's expected. So when we look at systems that control dialysis machines and airport navigation and autopilot in cars, and sure, the companies don't want the liability, so they're going to try to do their best. But there's really no control at the development level to say who is qualified to be working on this software. And we all know that above a certain level, they don't know what's going on inside of it. And I mean, it's impossible to audit all those lines of code, and even if they could understand all of them, unless you have some sort of pair programming approach, but how do you know both of those people aren't incompetent? So it's really difficult, and I don't know that there is a solution. I certainly haven't seen one. I don't think that the answer is to go down the road of that lawyers and doctors have necessarily and have some sort of bar that you have to pass in order to be a certified, you know, be allowed to practice in certain fields or in certain industries. But it's certainly a problem that's causing serious difficulties. And as our world becomes more automated and technology becomes more integrated into our daily lives, the risks are only going up.
Now, do you see that being amplified by back to one of the earlier questions regarding the, you know, the rise in boot camps? You have a lot of people, and, you know, I make the point that you get a lot of people kind of in that middle level where they're doing it because it's a good paycheck. It's something that, you know, doesn't suck, but maybe they're not super passionate about it. They're not driven to make sure they're delivering the best stuff. Are we running into issues, you think, where you get people who say, automation, there's going to be a lot of money in that, so I'm going to do that, regardless of whether or not that's something that's interesting to them, but rather, hey, it's something that can really, you know, can put the kids through college.
I think I maybe can answer that with a very brief example. Let's say, just something off the top of my head, that you have a system that manages home health care. And it's been built, it's established, it works fairly well. Your developers that built it are no longer around, but you need some minor tweaks made. You might approach someone from a boot camp who's learned the technologies that it uses to make those changes. And they might make them effectively. Or they might accidentally make a change that makes some minor difference in how the scheduling of medications is calculated. And this might not be a major enough change to be caught by QA or even immediately recognized in the market until there's been systemic negative impact on the customers that use this software. Those are the sort of things I'm worried about, because you're not going to hear about it. The company is not going to advertise that this happened. They might pay damages. There might be some sort of legal interaction, but barring a 60 minutes type of investigation, these things are going to go on and continue to build in the environment around us and be hidden dangers. And I'm not sure how to approach it.
I can tell you that I know David has had to deal with some system problems that code that I wrote created. Like as you get a more and more complex system, it's very easy to create a cascading failure condition, and there's more and more inputs to it, so you don't detect it. And I think as we're scaling out and what we're doing with tech, that's a very real possibility for critical systems. It's not just, you know, aircraft. It's like you said, you know, medicine being scheduled, or you know, health records getting out or getting corrupted in some way. There's so many entry points for problems, and I don't really think we've even thought about how to deal with that at scale. Like, most of our stuff that's scaled up in society right now happened over periods of hundreds of years. We're at an event horizon right now where it's not going to be hundreds of years. It's going to be in a lifetime or less.
Hopefully the lifetimes are hundreds of years, though, pretty soon.
Yeah, well, there is that.
Otherwise, what's all the medical science for, right? Come on, science.
To quote Queen, who wants to live forever?
I'll give it a shot.
Well, my thought is any systematic failure that creates a problem in the supply chain of bacon, then that's a real serious threat. As technology is more and more invasive, I don't want to see that happen.
So maybe the pork industry needs to fund some of this research.
That's right.
So what you're saying is we need an IOB, Internet of Bacon?
I'm already there.
Nice.
Let the record show that David Neal is currently snacking on a giant plate of bacon.
If he writes a library, it will be called bacon.js.
I would bet that there's already bacon.js out there.
I think there is.
If not, there is now.
Yeah. Well, guys, we want to thank y'all for coming on the show. There's a lot of exciting things coming out in the next few years, and, you know, a lot of exciting things and a lot of scary things in technology, you know, in the future. I know personally, I am excited and scared to hopefully in the next 5 years be a senior developer at some point. So, you know, I understand that. And yes, Will has found bacon.js on his phone. So it does exist on GitHub if you want to look it up. That pretty much wraps us up before we close everything out. Will, what do you have for us this week for Tricks of the Trade?
Well, I want to point out something, and that is the idea of looking at yourself as a first cause for the things you're experiencing. I ran into this a little while ago. I think I probably mentioned I was having a coworker that was getting to be kind of difficult to deal with. And, you know, I could get as mad as I want at the guy, and believe me, I have gotten as mad as I want, but that really doesn't fix anything. And what has, I think, helped a little bit is trying to figure out the levers that I can control. And so when you start looking for things where you're a first cause, that is how you do this.
So you look at all the variables involved in the situation. You know, does this person know that the tone that they're talking to you in is not acceptable? Like, are you going forward with your day and acting like, oh, that's totally fine, when you're in fact extremely ticked off about it? And I stopped putting up with that. You know, it was difficult conversations to have. You know, like, I don't like stirring stuff up at work and feeling like I'm picking a fight or I'm being overly sensitive, but it was stuff that made it very difficult to go to the day job every day. And as a result, I confronted him. I think that's actually helping. At the very least, it's making it where he is aware that the behavior is no longer acceptable and hasn't been. So it's still kind of on him. But what it did for me was it allowed me to be in a position where I don't feel cornered by the behavior. It is actually somebody else's problem. And instead of pushing that off on the other person, I'm going, look, this is not okay. I think really at its core, it's a matter of honesty. I was not being honest with some of the people I worked with about how much this was irritating me. And now I have been quite honest. In fact, maybe a little bit more direct than I absolutely had to be, but I'm hoping that this will work out. And I want to encourage people to start approaching things from that perspective, because it either gives you at least a sense of control, or it actually gets rid of the problem if you do that. You cannot control things beyond your control, but you can control the things you can control. And if you're not triaging at the level of figuring out which is which, you're going to have a bad time. So that's all I got.
Titanfall.
If you have a question or comment for us, please email us at neckbeards@completedeveloperpodcast.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from Stand By for Titanfall by Pure Bells, available on SoundCloud and licensed under Creative Commons. The intro music for IoTs is Hillbilly Hip Hop by Jason Belcher. For references, show notes, and to sign up to our email list, be sure and check out the website at CompleteDeveloperPodcast.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at CompleteDevPod and like our page on Facebook to keep up with the news about the show. Thanks for listening. See you next time.